Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is April 12th, 2024, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is For the Longest Time, to give TNK for an acute ischemic stroke. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Vashi Sirivasan, and he is an emergency medicine physician and neurointensivist at the University of Washington and Harborview Medical Center in Seattle, Washington. He's also an assistant professor in emergency medicine, neurology, and neurosurgery at the School of Medicine at the University of Washington. I think we've got all the bases covered here. Welcome to the SGEM, Vashi.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Ken. This should be a really interesting conversation today.
Yeah, I think it'll generate a fair bit of activity on the site formerly known as Twitter. And I think that's how we first connected.
Yeah, I feel like despite all the chaos that has come with the last couple of, I guess, years now of Twitter and the drama associated with that, Med Twitter has largely remained intact, and there really hasn't been a good replacement for it, for better or worse.
Yeah, I haven't seen something that could replace that connection that you can get. And again, we are that social media platform. What we put out there represents who we are. And so we can choose to be, you know, really honorable and kind, or we can choose vitriol. And I choose the former as opposed to the latter. So it was really great to reach out to you, meet you, and say, hey, do you have any time to do this timeless review with me? And you were like, yeah, sure. That sounds like fun.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, well, give us a case then.
Yeah, so this is based off of a case I actually had when I was attending in the ICU. This is a 70-year-old woman who was brought into the emergency department, and it really doesn't matter if it's a community hospital or if it's a comprehensive stroke center, level one, you know, all of the things. But 70-year-old woman comes into the emergency department, gets brought in by the ambulance. Her family calls 911 because she was having trouble talking at home. She sounded a little confused, and, you know, she wasn't acting her normal self earlier in the day. They just let her rest. They figured she was just tired. But then later that day, they noticed that she had trouble moving her right arm, and so that's when they called 911. The initial evaluation by medics revealed right hemiplegia, a right facial droop, left gaze deviation, and aphasia. And so they called ahead saying, yep, we're bringing this patient in. She's a stroke code. And when she arrives, her family's with her and says, oh yeah, she was totally fine this morning. And it's about, 12 hours ago at this point. So, you know, you get your stroke code activated per your institutional protocols, and you get the CT scan. There's no hemorrhage. There's no early ischemia. And you're raring to go. And you get your stroke people involved. You get the CT angiogram, and she's got that proximal middle cerebral artery occlusion. You get the CT perfusion, and it shows this tiny little core at 10 mLs. And a huge penumbra, almost the entire MCA territory at 189 mLs. And so you're on the phone with your stroke team, and, you know, you're talking about thrombectomy, and, you know, this looks like it's a pretty small stroke, and it looks like there's no early ischemic changes. Do you want to give thrombolysis also?
Yes, the proverbial question about thrombolytics. And this question about thrombolytics spans my whole career, actually, because acute ischemic stroke dates back 30 years to the initial NINS trial that was published in 1995, and that's when I graduated. And since that time, numerous stroke studies and analyses have been undertaken to categorize the potential benefits, but also the potential harms associated with thrombolysis and stroke. And we've discussed this issue multiple times on the SGEM, and I will list those in the show notes.
Yeah, I won't tell you what I was doing in 1995, but since that time, there's been numerous thrombectomy trials that have been published looking at the role of thrombectomy in acute ischemic stroke. And the real turning point was in 2015 when the numerous trials, there was actually five of them that were published, that showed the profound benefit of thrombectomy in acute ischemic stroke. And then in 2018, that window got extended from 6 hours up to now 24 hours after the publication of Dawn and Diffuse 3. And now the standard of care is mechanical thrombectomy for large vessel occlusion up to 24 hours, but thrombolysis is still used for strokes up to 4.5 hours from onset.
Yeah, and it was that Mr. Clean study back in 2015 that was published, and everybody went, wow, That was pretty impressive. And so those other four studies, I think all four of them were stopped early because of the impressive results with Mr. Clean. And we've looked at this issue of endovascular therapy with or without thrombolytics on the SGEM a few times, and I'll list those in the show notes as well. But there's also been several systematic reviews and meta-analyses on this issue. There's been a few guidelines published on the topic, and you heard this here first, ASEP is currently working on a new clinical policy to address this question of endovascular therapy plus or minus thrombolytics.
And the flavor of thrombolysis has actually changed too. Initially, it was Alteplase TPA, and that was the original NINS trial. That was the thrombolytic agent of choice. Basically, since then, it's been an effort to try to find, are there better agents? Is there a superior agent? Should we be using something else other than Alteplase? And Tenecteplase was sort of the new kid on the block that rolled around in 2012 after the Parsons trial that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Since then, it's been almost 12 years now since that original trial, and TPA has largely been replaced at most large centers. And the listeners will know what the agent is used at their local institution. For example, at our shop at the University of Washington at Harborview, we switched to Tenecteplase almost a year plus ago at this point. And so most large academic centers, I think, have changed over, and a lot of community shops as well. And you covered this on the SGEM a while back, covering, I think, the ACT trial, looking at the differences between TPA and TNK. And the ACT trial was a pragmatic, multi-center, open-label, registry-linked, randomized controlled non-inferiority trial. And this reported that it was at least non-inferior to TPA if you were treated within 4.5 hours of symptom onset. And then since then, there were numerous trials, and I'm not going to list all of them, but the most important ones to for the listeners to look up are the TEST trial from the UK, the Extend IATNK trial. There were parts 1 and 2. That was done in Australia and New Zealand. There was a NorTrest trials, part 1, part 2A, part 2B. All of them were Norwegian trials. And all of these trials kind of in aggregate have shown that Tenecteplase is neither superior to Alteplase, but it's also not inferior to Alteplase. So it's at best a toss-up. It really doesn't matter which agent you use. You're probably getting the same efficacy. There may be some other associated benefits. Tenecteplase is a one-time bolus as opposed to a bolus plus a drip. There's less math involved. So there are some benefits outside of the trials themselves, but largely they are equivalent in terms of their efficacy, safety profile, and harms.
Yeah, and I want to give a shout out to the ACT trial authors, because that was a Canadian trial, and, you know, I'm Canadian, eh? And they did a really good job. You know, it's always difficult to perform these large randomized trials. And, you know, we're not here to just criticize. We're here just to evaluate and say, hey, what did they do? How did they do it? And we did cover the ACT trial, and they did a good job looking at TNK to see if it was non-inferior to TPA. But moving on, perfusion imaging allows a more careful patient selection for therapy, as you can identify patients with salvageable penumbrum or salvageable ischemic tissue that can be, quote, rescued if reperfused versus those who have this large burden of infarct, this big core size that cannot be recovered with reperfusion. However, this requires some advanced software not readily available in most emergency departments and is generally only found in those large referral centers with comprehensive stroke center designations. The standard criteria for intervention comes from the DIFFUSE 3 trial and is reflected in the inclusion criteria for this study that we're going to cover today. So, hey, give us the clinical question.
Yeah, so the question here in this trial that's being looked at is, does giving Tenecteplase TNK between 4.5 hours to 24 hours from symptom onset using perfusion imaging to select patients improve outcomes after stroke?
Yeah, so they're really trying to say after 4.5 hours, you know, do we have a patient population? Is there a subgroup there that we can tease out using advanced imaging and perfusion software and stuff like that, that we say, yeah, these two have a potential benefit. So what was the reference?
Yeah, so this is the Albers et al. Trial by the Timeless Investigators, and it's tenecteplase for stroke at 4.5 to 24 hours with perfusion imaging selection, published in the New England Journal of Medicine in February of 2020.
Yes, let's go through the PCOT. What was the population that they included?
Yeah, so this trial enrolled adults 18 years of age with independent function, so a modified Rankin score of 0 to 2, pre-stroke, with an ischemic stroke, and they could also receive the drug or placebo within 4.5 to 24 hours from the last known well time. They also needed to have at least an NIH stroke scale of 5, and they needed to have an ICA or MCA occlusion on CTA or MRA. Also, as part of the inclusion criteria, they needed to satisfy the diffuse 3 criteria for perfusion imaging, which was a core less than 70 mLs, that's that infarcted tissue, the penumbra greater than 15 mLs, which is the salvageable tissue, and a core penumbra ratio of at least 1.8.
And so they had a number of exclusions, and we'll list those in the show notes. What was the intervention?
So the intervention was tenecteplase TMK at 0.25 milligrams per kilogram with a max dose of 25 milligrams.
Yeah, that seems to be the dose where the world is settled, right? The research has sort of settled on 0.25 milligrams per kilogram, because I know in some other studies they did use a higher dose of tenecteplase.
Yeah, so the several of the studies looked at 0.4 with a max dose of 40 and higher doses. And like you said, the literature has largely settled on using 0.25 mg per kg as the standard dose from here on out.
And what did they compare it to?
This was compared against placebo.
And let's go through their outcomes. What was their primary outcome?
This was modified Rankin score at day 90.
All right. And they had a number of secondary efficacy outcomes and a number of secondary safety outcomes. And I'll list those in the show notes. What type of study was this?
Yeah, so this was a phase 3 multi-center double-masked randomized placebo-controlled trial.
All right. Let's get to the author's conclusions then. They said, quote, tenecteplase therapy that was initiated 4.5 to 24 hours after stroke onset in patients with occlusions of the middle cerebral artery or internal carotid artery, most of whom undergone endovascular thrombectomy, did not result in better clinical outcomes than those with placebo. The incidence of symptomatic intracerebral hemorrhage was similar in the two groups. End of quote. All right, so the next step in our quality assessment is to use a checklist, and we've got 12 questions for randomized control trials, and the answers are yes, no, or unsure. So you ready to go?
Let's do it.
All right, so are these emergency department patients?
Yes.
And do you think that the patients were adequately randomized?
Yes, they were.
And was the randomization process concealed?
Yes.
And were the patients analyzed into the groups to which they were randomized?
Yes.
The study patients were recruited consecutively, so we didn't have any potential selection bias.
That's less sure. I'm unsure about that. They didn't explicitly state that in the manuscript.
Yeah, it would make it so much easier if they just said patients were recruited consecutively. You know, you sometimes have to dig, or they say all patients, but it would be really nice if they just explicitly said that. The patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes, I believe the demographics were listed and they were largely the same.
All right, let's go through the masking. So if everyone was unaware of group allocation, and this is the patients, clinicians, and the outcome assessors.
So patients, yes. Clinicians, yes. Outcome assessors, no.
And were all groups treated equally except for that intervention, so the tenecteplase versus the placebo?
Yes.
And how was their follow-up? Was it complete enough?
Yeah, it was actually very, very good. They only lost 6 patients to follow-up. That's only 1.6% of the total patient population in this study.
Yeah, it's really good. Do you think all patient important outcomes were considered?
Yes. They, as you said, there was several secondary efficacy outcomes and safety outcomes, and they did a really thorough job of kind of looking at all aspects of the drug.
And the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Yes, both large and precise.
You know, you're getting it. All right, so, and then the final question is, how about financial conflicts of interest or funding for the study?
Yeah, so this is kind of the X factor. Is that the trial was funded by Genentech, the drug manufacturer of tenecteplase, and the authors did disclose multiple conflicts of interest.
All right, let's get to the results. They recruited 458 patients into the TIMELESS trial. The median age was in the early 70s, with slightly more being female. The median NIHSS score was 12, and the median duration from last seen well was 12 and a half hours. So like in the case you presented, she looked good 12 hours ago. Around 8% of the patients had an internal carotid occlusion. Half of them had an M1 segment, and 38% had an M2 segment. Now, they planned endovascular therapy in 87% of the patients, so the vast majority, but only 77% actually had the procedure performed. So, what was the key result?
The key result. This is what we've all been waiting for. There was no superiority of tenecteplase over placebo in stroke patients with large vessel occlusions treated between 4.5 and 24 hours last seen well.
And can you put some numbers on this for that primary outcome? Because that was the median score on the MRS scale at 90 days.
Yeah, so the median score on the modified Rankin scale at 90 days, it was 3, and the interquartile range was 1 to 5. And that was in the tenecteplase group. The placebo group, it was also 3, with an interquartile range of 1 to 4.
So that gives us an adjusted odds ratio of 1.13, and that 95% confidence interval spans 1, and the p-value was 0.45, so no statistical significance and not even close. How about secondary outcomes?
Yeah, so no statistical significant difference in functional independence, reperfusion after 24 hours, or reperfusion at the conclusion of thrombectomy, but they did have rater recanalization of the vessel at 24 hours with tenecteplase.
And we'll put the actual numbers in the show notes for those people who want to dive into that. How about the secondary safety outcomes?
Death within 30 days, it was almost exactly the same, 14.7% versus 15%. Death within 90 days, almost exactly the same, 19.7 versus 18.2. And the rates of symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage were also similar, 3.2 versus 2.3%.
Yeah, so very similar with regards to the safety outcomes. My favorite part, I get to talk nerdy with you. Are you ready to talk nerdy?
Let's do it.
Oh, I love talking nerdy. All right, so the first thing, let's just get this one out of the way. This is the conflict of interest. The trial was funded by Genentech. The sponsors helped design the study and provided the tenecteplase and the placebo. They were also responsible for monitoring the sites and for data management. There were several Genentech employees as authors on the manuscript, and two of them provided the data analysis. Authors who were not employees also declared conflicts of interest. There is literature base that suggests that conflicts of interest can introduce bias into randomized control trials. However, that does not mean in this specific trial suffers from that bias, but it should make us more skeptical.
Yeah. You know, usually bias would make us think that the company would want us to believe that their drug works in this indication, but it's interesting to note that the study was actually a negative study in that case and showed no significant difference between the two groups.
So what you're saying is that because there's so many declared conflicts of interest and financial involvement from the company, because, and I try to avoid saying negative or positive, but because they didn't demonstrate superiority, you have even more confidence in this result?
Well, I think we, recognizing that anytime there is a conflict of interest or that there is a manufacturer or a drug company sponsored study for their own product, there at least is a concern that the study may want to be more supportive of the product or the drug that they're trying to investigate. And in this case, since that wasn't the case, you almost want to believe the study more.
Yeah, so I think you would refer to that as the spin, right? The spin on the study. And they didn't find superiority.
So nerdy point number two, the trial was conducted at 112 sites. It was 108 in the United States and 4 in Canada. And it took them 4 to 6 months to recruit the 458 patients required based on their power analysis for the primary outcome. And this only really works out to about 1 patient per site per year, which doesn't seem like a lot. And I kind of wonder, did they have trouble enrolling people? Did they only have certain hours of the day that they were able to enroll people, that, you know, what was going on there that they had so few patients per site per year that actually were enrolled.
Yeah, and that's where my skepticism came in about the, are these consecutive patients? And I'm unsure because they didn't say consecutive patients, but you work at a big stroke center. Would you see more than one patient per year that would fit this clinical scenario that would be eligible for this sort of therapy?
I mean, we work 8-hour shifts in our emergency department, and I think we see more than one patient per shift some days. And so it just strikes me as odd that what was going on in these 112 sites that prevented them from enrolling more than one patient per year per site. And, you know, obviously some sites, I'm sure, enrolled a lot more, and some sites didn't enroll as many. And having participated in multi-center studies, I know how challenging it can be to enroll patients in general, but it still just kind of makes me go, interesting.
Perhaps we got it wrong, and I will reach out once this show gets up. I plan to reach out to the corresponding author, and maybe they can answer that for us. Nerdy point number three is about safety. The point estimates for symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage and death were all worse with tenecteplase, but the study was not powered for safety. It was powered for efficacy. And although these point estimates were not statistically different, you could argue that the person who died felt it was clinically significant, but we don't know if more people necessarily would have died if the study was powered properly to tease out the safety. Looking at the randomized control trials that address this subject of safety with thrombolytics, 5 out of the 6 studies had more bleeding, and 4 out of the 6 had higher mortality rates. And I'll list the details in the show notes about those safety metrics.
Yeah, this is a topic that is has been kind of debated, discussed, agonized over in hundreds and hundreds of papers ever since thrombolysis for stroke originally was proposed.
Yeah, it would make sense that giving somebody a thrombolytic would increase the likelihood of bleeding. So I don't think it's a big leap. But every drug has potential benefits and potential harms in it, and we really need to look at the net, because if the potential benefits outweigh a small but real harm, then that's the decision that the patient makes based on their risk and their risk tolerance.
Right, and you know, the safety, and sort of anytime we talk about bleeding for acute ischemic stroke and thrombolysis, and this is sort of where we can get really nerdy and start talking about the Heidelberg classification. And is all bleeding by definition a harm? Or, you know, do we really care about that ECAS-2 criteria where you have the parenchymal hemorrhage type 2, where you've got the big clot in the stroke bed? Is that really what we care about? Or do we care about hemorrhage associated with the NIH stroke scale increase? And so I think there's a lot of nuance in this that we really have to kind of delve into the weeds of the statistics in these individual studies to kind of get a sense of how safe versus unsafe are these therapies that we're proposing to our patients.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of nuance to it. And, you know, we can always go to the objective data, alive or dead. But then there's a quality to that, because sometimes death may be preferable to severely neurologically damaged. And so, again, that brings in some subjectivity. The numbers are what they are. It's just up to us and our patients to try to interpret them to how it applies to each specific case in some kind of shared decision model.
100% agree. I think it's important for us to make sure that we're very honest with our patients and their families or their surrogates to explain the risks and the benefits and work with them to help them make whatever decision that they choose to make. So let's talk about the per protocol analysis. This type of analysis tends to bias results towards finding superiority, but despite using this type of analysis and that bias, they still didn't find tenecteplase to be superior to placebo in these patients.
Yeah, and again, that makes me even more confident in the results. So you've got an industry-sponsored trial, lots of conflicts of interest, and then even they do a per-protocol analysis for a superiority trial and don't demonstrate superiority. Again, that increases my confidence that what we're seeing really reflects the quote-unquote truth. And when I use the term truth, I'm talking about the best point estimate of an observed effect size with a confidence interval around that point estimate.
Yeah, the supplemental figures have this data, and you can look at the protocol population and see what actually the effects were on the modified Rankin score at 90 days for the per protocol analysis.
All right, the fifth and final point was about endovascular therapy, or EVT. Most patients, and when I say most, it was 77%, in this trial got EVT. They did a subgroup analysis, and even in the subgroup analysis, it did not support the use of tenecteplase for those patients undergoing EVT. Now, the evidence is mixed on the efficacy of what's referred to sometimes as bridging therapy in these patients. And the authors did provide several possible explanations for why they did not observe superiority in patients who did receive EVT with tenecteplase. And like I teased out earlier, ASEP has a clinical policy in process that's going to be coming out sometime in this year, I hope, that will address that question.
It should be interesting, because I think, you know, as when I wear my EM physician hat, it's important that we sort of follow guidelines and follow the evidence and work with our local institutional policies and our local stroke crew to make sure that we're kind of all in agreement on the best way forward. But it's also nice to have national guidelines to help guide what we do.
Well, two things I want to clear up then. When you're talking about your EM hat, you're talking obviously about a biking helmet.
That's correct. As opposed to when I'm in the ICU, I don't know what kind of a hat a neurointensivist would wear.
But we do know from glaucoma Flecken that it's a bike helmet
for
the emergency physician. Yeah. And then the other thing was about, we're all on team patients. So let's get all together on the same team. We have common ground. We're trying to provide patients with the best care based on the best evidence available to us. All right. Well, it's time to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
Yeah. So I think we actually agree with the authors. Based on this data, there isn't really a benefit to administering tenecteplase in this patient population.
All right, and can you give us an SGEM bottom line?
So there continues to be a lack of evidence to support the use of thrombolytics beyond 4.5 hours in acute ischemic stroke.
And how about resolving the case that you presented?
Yeah, so thrombolysis was ultimately not offered to that patient. She was taken urgently for a mechanical thrombectomy. They had T3 recanalization, or full reperfusion of the affected vessel. And she was admitted to the neuro ICU for post-procedure monitoring and ultimately actually did okay.
It's nice to hear that when patients do well. And how are you going to take this timeless study and apply it clinically?
Yeah, so I think this study adds to the existing literature base that shows that the longest time for thrombolytics remains less than 4.5 hours. We didn't see a superiority for thrombolysis beyond the 4.5 hour window, and there's maybe the suggestion of increased harm. And absolutely, patients with large vessel occlusion should be preferentially directed towards the thrombectomy suite without delays. That's ultimately what they need.
Yeah, and we're not going to rehash the strength and weaknesses of the evidence for thrombolytics and acute ischemic stroke under 4.5 hours. That's been discussed many times. And if people want to read more about my thoughts on this issue, there is a Canadian Journal of Emergency Medicine debate with Dr. Eddie Lang. There's the Lown Institute article with Dr. Daniel Fadovich, and the number needed to treat assessment that I did with Dr. Justin Morgenstern. So now this is a difficult task, is taking some complicated information and then translating that to the patient's bedside and talking to them or their family. How would you do that?
Yeah, so I think, when I have this conversation with families, I tell them, it looks like grandma's having a stroke. And because it's been more than 4.5 hours, that clot-busting drug that people can get hasn't been shown to work for her this far out. But because this big artery is blocked, we have to do a procedure to take that clot out. And I actually liken it to roto-rootering. I don't know if, a trademark for whoever owns that copyright, but that's the analogy I use, and I think patients respond well to that there's a clogged pipe and we have to go in and rotor the clot out and let them know that the stroke team's coordinating this and it's going to happen as soon as possible.
All All right, it's time to announce the Keener contest winner. And last episode was another win for Dr. Cindy Bitter. She knew the oldest alcohol was found in pottery excavated from a Neolithic village in the Yellow River Valley in Henan Province in China, dating all the way back to 7,000 BCE. Do you have a question for this week?
Yeah, so it's actually on topic, and it's this. Tenecteplase has not yet been approved by the FDA for the treatment of acute ischemic stroke. However, it has been approved for the treatment of myocardial infarction. The question is, what year did the FDA approve TNK for STEMI?
Yeah, that's a good question. And just because the FDA hasn't approved something doesn't mean physicians don't use it and can't use it. And we've seen this with alteplase because the FDA has never approved alteplase for acute ischemic stroke beyond 3 hours. But it's, of course, used routinely, and now it's being transitioned to tenecteplase. So if you know what year the FDA did approve tenecteplase, and I shouldn't say STEMI because Dr. Amo Matu might get upset for OMIs. If you know that date, then send an email to the sjam@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Well, this is one of the wonderful things I love about social media. I get to make new friends. So thanks very much for coming on the SJAM, critically appraising this paper, and starting the conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This was a lot of fun, and maybe we can talk about something else in the future, too.
Absolutely.
Stroke it's going to be the big hot topic in the next, I think, 10 to 20 years of our careers. And I've always kind of joked that stroke, especially ischemic stroke, has been about 15 to 20 years behind MI. And, you know, we initially started treatments of occlusive MIs with thrombolysis, and then we moved to thrombectomies, essentially, or angioplasty. And we're doing the exact same thing with stroke now. We started with thrombolysis, which kind of maybe sort of worked and maybe didn't. But now we're moving on to a definitive therapy that we know actually works really well with very low number needed to treat and has a profound effect size. And so I'm looking forward to what the next 10 to 20 years worth of data is going to show us.
Well, until the next paper gets published and I invite you to come back on or you suggest a paper to me, can you read the SJAM tagline?
Yeah, remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time. For the longest time.